So as we settle into our practice, there's no need to be looking too far away for what is relevant and useful for our Dhamma practice. To say our breath, our body, our mind, these are not distant phenomena. They're displaying truth at, all the time. So it's just learning how to read it, learning how to recognize it, learning how to pay attention to it. And sometimes the most ordinary things are the most useful and most powerful. This morning, at the end of morning chanting, we finished with the chant, which is the five subjects for frequent recollection. And this is a teaching that the Buddha gave that it isn't really just for chanting once in a while, but is something that the Buddha encouraged us to be contemplating, reflecting on, certainly at least on a daily basis, but as many times a day as we can recollect, as we can remember. I'm of the nature to age, I've not gone beyond aging. I'm of the nature to sicken, I've not gone beyond sickness. I'm of the nature to die, I have not gone beyond dying. All that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise, will become separated from me. I'm the owner of my karma, heir to my karma, born of my karma, related to my karma, abide supported by my karma. Whatever I shall do, for good or for ill, of that I will be the heir. So these recollections are very helpful, very important for bringing an urgency. One of the words that the Buddha uses is sangveka, and that's a sense of urgency. Not in the sense of being frantic, because being frantic doesn't actually help, but being extremely present and motivated and willing to put forth whatever it takes to deal with these realities of the human condition, to seek truth, to seek liberation, seek a freedom from suffering. 'Cause whether we practice or we don't practice, I'm of the nature to age, if not come beyond aging, I'm of the nature to sick. It's we're faced with the same situation. So that using it as a motivating factor or cultivation of that sense of spiritual urgency. Maybe that's a better way of putting it. So that there's a recollection of truth that motivates us. And of course, when the Buddha himself recounts his own motivation for going forth and seeking liberation, that's an aspect that he points to. You know, see, of course, the the story and kind of the mythology is the Buddha going out with his charioteer and seeing an old person and something that he's never seen before, or seeing a sick person, something he's never seen before, seeing a dead person, something he's never seen before. And I think as a tale that is hard to believe that somebody can get to 29 years of age and never having seen such things. But on another level, it's really true, because not having, having seen and then not internalized, not reflected on it. Yeah, that's very possible, because you don't have to go very far to recognize that within ourselves. These fundamental realities of the human condition, we can gloss over them, avoid them, keep ourselves distracted in whatever way we can, just try to forget about it. The Buddha encouraging us to consciously contemplate and to recollect these fundamental realities of the human condition. And when we do that, there is a turning of the mind. And it's actually in the Tibetan tradition, they talk about four thoughts that turn the mind. And one is the preciousness of human birth, and particularly having taken human birth with the opportunity of encountering a spiritual path. The second one is the inevitability of death, and as well as the uncertainty of death, in terms of, because sometimes we can think in terms of, death is inevitable and comes to everybody when they get really old, and something like that, and it doesn't really apply to us because we're not old yet. And I talked to my mother, she's 90 this year, and she was saying, I still don't feel old yet. And it's sort of it's a feeling. I mean, she obviously recognizes that life is carrying on. But it's that feeling it's always pushed outside of our experience somehow, outside of our out of our time frame that we actually have to deal with it. We know we have to deal with it sometime, but not now. So there's thoughts of the inevitability and uncertainty of death. The third thought in the Tibetan tradition that they point to is the infallibility of kamma, which is similar to that the recollection in the that the Buddha has, and so I'm born of my kamma, related to my kamma, so it's our actions that drive us and condition what we experience, how we perceive, how we feel about things. It's actions of body, speech, and mind. So that bringing a... and we say thoughts that turn the mind, of course, turning the mind to a path, a training, a turning the mind to Dhamma. And the last thought that they use in the Tibetan tradition for thoughts that turn the mind is the pervasive nature of suffering in conditioned existence. There is this inevitable experience of dukkha. And even something that is pleasant and delightful is also fraught with dukkha, in the sense that, one, we have to be separated from it; two, we have no way to control how long it can last, so that there is this nature of dukkha, of suffering, of unsatisfactoriness, and it's pervasive, and it's not. That's not a value judgment. It's just sort of, it's the way it is, and the more willing we are to look at it clearly, then the more capable we are of being being clear in the face of the reality of existence. And to be able to be clear then gives us the opportunity to make choices. And of course, if we're clear and wise, the choices that we make are the choices that lead to well-being, to peace, to happiness, to understanding, to freedom and liberation. And those are choices that we make. We make choices all the time. And whether the choices are for increased complication and confusion, or increased clarity and well-being, those are opportunities that we have, which of course is why we practice, so that we can make those choices informed by Dhamma, informed by truth. When the Buddha gave those five subjects for frequent recollection, I'm sure there's many discourses where the Buddha pointed to that, but there's one in particular where he gave the reasons for that, and the contemplation of aging is to counter the intoxication with youth. Because even when, say, I'm 64, so even when you're 64, like 50 seems really youthful. Remember the good old days. The mind goes to that when one could actually remember things. or whatever. The contemplation of the of sickness is to counter the intoxication with health, and because sometimes we assume that good health is actually the baseline And you know, we should be trying to always get back to our baseline of good health. But yeah, there's always something going wrong with the body, so that it's a lot of work to keep trying to do that, and there is an intoxication. There is an assumption that needs frequent contemplation. You know, some kind of illness and whether it's a cold or whether it's something catastrophic, there's always something that is happening. So that to be able to contemplate the inevitability of illness. The way the mind handles it is I remember one time being still fairly young monk, and I got a fever. Very much like typhoid fever. It wasn't. It was it's actually from a bug bite of some sort, a mite, but symptoms very, very similar to typhoid fever, you have these 2 weeks of incredibly high fevers. First week being very high, and then the second week goes off the charts. And remember being sick with this, and just fever and headache, and then worrying about fearful of what's this going to do? How do I get better? Will I get better? How do I do that? When will this end? And then kicks into the second week, and the fevers are up like over 105, 106, and then I start worrying, God, maybe I am going to get better, and I'm just not going to have a mind left. And it was just, the mind just goes, the different ways that we kind of fear or assumption, worry, or so this is having a human body where we're subject to all sorts of illnesses. Contemplating death is to counter the intoxication with life. I mean, all of our identification of who we are is with us as a living being, and it's obviously quite difficult to contemplate to go against that, but it is a reality that is worthy of contemplation because there's so many. So many fears that we carry, and it's normal, it's ordinary, but as we practice Dhamma, you realize that these are the tools that we're given that allow us to go beyond the ordinary, go beyond the normal, and it's such a precious gift that the Buddha's given us. The contemplation of separation from the loved, and just to counter the normal tendency to have desire and attachment to the things that we love, whether they're other people, our relationships, our material things, the world around us. To be able to step back from the habit of desire and attachment. And then the contemplation of kamma is the contemplation of that allows us to recognize that we're without truth discerning awareness, we easily slip into actions of body, speech, and mind that result in some kind of pain or discomfort, and encouraging ourselves to incline and develop the foundations of the path and training that put us firmly rooted in what is truly skillful, what's truly good, and that's something that we're all capable of. It's something that we all can do, and so that all these, I said, these contemplations are things which are very close to us. I mean, they're very ordinary. But it's the attention to the things that are closest to us, I think, that allow us to penetrate truth. If we continually cast our attention off to some kind of mythological, philosophical distance where everything is all right and everything is going to be surrounded in truth, then it's just something over there. It's something away from us. And that's one of the when we do the chanting every day, chanting the recollections of the Dhamma. One of the qualities of the Dhamma is opanayiko. That means leading inwards. So leading it inwards, drawing this teaching, drawing this practice into the heart, into our own experience. As this is where we have the opportunity to really experience the Dhamma. And it is that experience, again, that motivates us and encourages us. And because it's our experience, both of the, the painful, unwanted elements of our existence that motivate us, but it's also the experience of when we touch on something that feels really true, that feels peaceful, that feels clear, that motivates us also. That's the big. There's that sense of this is true. The heart resonates with it, and that motivation to practice is there. So it isn't as if contemplations are just something to scare you into practice. What they're doing is, cutting away or taking away the dross, taking away the things that are unnecessary, and coming to something that's very immediate. One time his Holiness the Dalai Lama was asked a very simple question: what's the point of your practice? And he gave a very simple answer. I'm preparing to die. And so just a very, very simple, very direct, but also very wise. And of course, His Holiness almost, you know, always embodies that and shines that light into the world for the rest of us. So as we contemplate these aspects of the teachings and of the ways of directing our attention, it's just is helpful to have those reminders. Because it's it's so easy to forget. I think of an image that Ajahn Chah used one time sort of saying, we're kind of like chickens, and chickens sort of the owner of the chicken sort of throws out the rice for it in the yard, and the chicken sort of scratches around and eats the rice every day, and then it goes into its little chicken coop in the evening and has a nice rest and comes out in the morning, and the owner's thrown out more rice and it scratches around, spends its days sort of eating and sleeping, and from time to time the owner comes along and picks it up and holds it for a bit, and the chicken sort of thinks, oh God, he's a really nice guy. He gives me food, gives me a place to stay, he picks me up and gives me attention, but it doesn't realize that the owner is sort of picking him up and sort of, how much does he weigh? Is he ready to go to market yet? sooner or later, he's off to market, it's not quite the ending he was hoping for. So remember one time Ajahn Chah, it was the last year that he was had decent health, and he was still teaching, but his health was was really up and down, and he said our bodies are just like a lump of ice, and put a lump of ice outside and it just keeps, there's only one way it's going. It's gonna melt away. And he put it out, and especially where he was staying, it was actually one of his favorite places. Where it's called Tamsang Pet. It's called the Cave of the Diamond Light. It's a 1,000 acres of forest and hill, and a lot of open rock. And so, putting a big lump of ice out on the open rock. It's just, there's only one way it's going to go. His ability to view his own physical, mental decline, and look at it in a way, isn't that interesting? Mm-hmm. That was, and I think that's one of the things that as practitioners, again, it's not to elicit some kind of morbid fear or worry, because those are inherently unwholesome mental states, and the intention of the Buddha for us to be contemplating things in any kind of practice is to be bringing into being wholesome mental states, so that a wholesome mental state that, you know, just like, say, Ajahn Chah, say, isn't that interesting? We're just like blocks of ice, just sort of fading away. And you know, somebody, you look at that, and it's just, it's kind of curious and kind of interesting how that is. And there's a there's both a sobering as well as a curiosity as well as a kind of a brightness that's there. Say, as opposed to oh my God, we're just like a block of ice. And, you know, that stimulates a different kind of a mental state. And you want to be paying attention to how we're applying our reflections, applying our minds, so that it's encouraging us. And the encouragement to take the human condition seriously, and to put forth effort, so that we're able to penetrate the truth of our existence, and it's the freedom that arises is not distant. It's not far away. It's with that recognition and a letting go that we experience that freedom. So picking up the teachings and reflecting on them, picking up the teachings and drawing them into the heart. And you know, some will resonate, some won't, we just have to keep trying, you keep experimenting, you keep being interested in the Dhamma. I'm thinking of a discourse that the Buddha gave, where he talked of the three kinds of sick people. So there's a sick person who, whether they do or don't receive amenable food, amenable medicines, and proper nursing, whether they get those things or they don't, they still pass away. They still succumb to that illness. And then there's, say, people who, whether they receive amenable food, amenable medicines, proper nursing, whether they do or don't receive those things, they get better. And then there's the third kind of person who absolutely needs that, you know, the proper food, proper medicines, proper nursing in order for them to get better. But then the Buddha goes on to say, because it's impossible to tell which is which, so that you... That's, he said, and that's why I've allowed food and medicines and encourage you to nurse the sick, because you can't really, you don't know which person is which. You can't tell, and that's also why one. Is kind of unstinting in trying to provide proper food, proper medicine, proper nursing for somebody who is ill, because they could be in that category of a person who responds to that treatment. And then the Buddha goes on to say, in the same way, there's people who, whether they say they, whether they see the Tathagata, they meet the Buddha, whether they hear the teachings, receive the training, they never penetrate the Dhamma. And there's those people who, yeah, whether they do or don't see or meet the Buddha, hear the teachings, receive a training, they do penetrate them. They penetrate truth. And they're say, self-reliant. And I said, and then there's those who say, absolutely need that opportunity to come in contact with the Tathagata, with the teaching, with the training, in order for them to penetrate truth. And then it's because of, say, that third category, because you can't tell which is which, who is who, that one kind of unstintingly and with compassion always provides, trying to provide the conditions for people to practice. And, you know, the reality is, you know, people's minds sort of, well, I must be in that category where it's sort of hopeless anyway. So, but we don't know. And the reality is, I would expect that in the same way that there's a minority of people who get better without medicines and whatnot, or don't, but the majority, vast majority, will always fall into the category of that's what they need. And similarly with the teaching, the training, the practice, and contact with the Buddha's Buddha's example. Vast majority need that, and that's where we probably all lie. So that to be taking an interest in these teachings, because it is, in some ways, the Buddha, he compares himself to a doctor who's giving a medicine for freeing one from illness, and so that of course the illness is suffering, and the Buddha's teachings are a medicine to allay that human tendency to experience suffering in its many different ways, so that as take these teachings, take these contemplations, what's important is how do we turn it to the Dhamma? How do we bring it into the heart and make it relevant and useful for us? How do we create a wholesome sense of urgency where we take an interest in the application of these teachings and allowing them to really bear fruit? So I'll offer that for reflection this afternoon.